Welcome to this week's Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today is Colin Lowe, Chartered Financial Planner and Managing Director of Kingsfleet Wealth. There have been some massive changes to the pensions landscape over the past few years, but amendments to the way we save for retirement were almost conspicuous by their absence in Wednesday's budget. However, it was confirmed that the pensions lifetime allowance will rise in April next year from 1 million to 1,030,000. Colin, this doesn't sound like very much. Will it actually make much of a difference?
Well, yes, it will. And I think one of the great things with pensions is no news is good news when it comes to a budget. So this very small, seemingly small increase is positive because at least it is now following through on the promise that was made previously. So yes, it makes a difference if someone is withdrawing funds from their pension and at a point of what's called a benefit crystallisation event, their arrangements are assessed against this lifetime allowance of £1 million.
Okay, now what can people do if they are nudging up towards a lifetime allowance?
So the issue now is to bear in mind that it doesn't just apply to people who have money purchase schemes or personal pensions, but also it does apply to anyone who has a final salary scheme, a deferred scheme perhaps. Those schemes, the amount of the pension provision is multiplied by 20. So if, for example, you have a pension benefit of £25,000 on a final salary scheme, then that counts as £500,000, £500,000 towards your lifetime allowance. So there are some things that you can't change. You can't change the amount of the deferred benefit in your final salary scheme. But perhaps if we just focus on people with money purchase arrangements, then they can do maybe three things. The first thing is they could, if they're able to and they're over 55, they could crystallise the benefits. So that stops it increasing. So that says that's the level I want to draw the line at. So let's say you reach 950,000, you say, I don't want to go over the line. You could start taking your benefits and it's assessed against that. The second thing is you could just move it into cash. So you don't want it to grow any further. Again, let's say you'd reached 950 and you said, actually, I don't want to take the risk of it increasing in value. The third option is to ignore it and just realise that you pay it. And increasingly, people are now treating that lifetime allowance tax beyond that level, a bit like inheritance tax, really, in that perhaps if the value of your property goes up, then ultimately you just realise that's something that needs to be assessed, but it still has a benefit to the people who you want to leave the pension to in the future.
Okay, thank you, Colin. Some really helpful explanations there. Now, an area of tax-efficient investing where there were some changes announced in the budget is enterprise investment schemes. Colin, what is an enterprise investment scheme, or EIS for short, and how are the rules on these changing?
Well, we'll try and keep this quite brief. So, enterprise investment schemes are effectively very tax-beneficial investment arrangements where the investment goes into the ownership of a qualifying small business. The qualifying small business bit we'll come back to a bit later, but the benefit of an investor going into that is that they obtain 30% income tax relief once the shares are invested. It can defer capital gains tax on the same value of the investment, and after 2 years, typically, the fund is exempt from inheritance tax. So it's a very highly tax efficient arrangement, but it's because the underlying investment should be invested in a small qualifying business.
Now, the change that was announced in the budget, there were a few changes, but there was a main change, I think, concerns investors. What was that?
So yeah, you'll notice that I said should be invested in a small...
Yeah.
What has happened is there's been a very significant part of the market invested in an aspect which is really there to preserve capital. Mm. Now, therefore, it's not significantly risky. There are risks attached, but it's not as risky as perhaps the Chancellor would prefer. So in order to get all those good tax benefits, he is now suggesting, the Treasury is now saying that what they would like is for higher levels of risk to be incorporated within enterprise investment schemes. And the particular focus is on going into knowledge intensive businesses. Their term, not mine. We're not entirely sure what that means, but what we do know is that certainly by the end of this tax year, there will be a real focus on taking greater risk within enterprise investment schemes. And that's in exchange for the very, very significant tax benefits of going in.
Okay, now another change they mentioned was the amount you can invest in them. I think I'm correct in thinking that you, once upon a time, you could put up to 1 million a year
currently
into these schemes, which is very generous, but
yes,
now that is rising to 2 million a year. In view of the fact that the allowance is more generous, should people you know, who've approaching, I don't know, the lifetime limit of pensions. Should they plunge into these enterprise investment schemes?
Yeah, there's a great line that you will have heard many times that says, don't let the tax tail wag the investment dog. So just because something has a significant tax benefit doesn't mean to say it's necessarily an appropriate investment for somebody. So that's the fundamental rule of investing. The second aspect, though, is to say that because the risk profile of these arrangements is likely to increase quite significantly, that is why there is that significant tax benefit. So going back to our first discussion about the lifetime allowance and that being capped, yes, people are using tax incentivised arrangements as a support for their pension planning, but there are all alternative arrangements to EISs like VCTs, venture capital trusts, that doesn't necessarily tie someone in for such a long period of time and isn't focused in such a small area of the market that EISs will be going after. So there are arrangements that are there. Yes, they're all tax beneficial. Yes, they're worth considering, but you must be very, very careful that you are willing and able to take significant risks and be proposed to suffer losses in those areas.
So with that in mind, what kind of investors should use EIS and how should they use them in their portfolios?
Yeah, so the first thing is they have to be appropriately aware of the risks that they could be taking. That is the key thing. The second thing is perhaps they will be somebody who sees a benefit from a income tax perspective. So they may be a high earner, they may be somebody who, as you say previously, were putting in significant funds into pensions and are either feeling the pinch in terms of the lifetime allowance or the annual allowance of contributions.
40,000.
Which is 40,000.
Or less for some higher earners.
Yes, that's right. And that actually is reduced. You're quite right. Mm. If you really are a significant earner, that does get reduced hugely.
£10,000.
Yeah, these figures keep changing, and it's important just to be clear about that. So yes, some people are prepared to take that risk, are prepared to look at arrangements like EISs and VCTs, but they do need to be aware that we are not talking the same investment arrangements as you could hold within a pension plan.
Not for most people.
Not for everybody. Certainly not for everybody.
Now, other than the pension's lifetime allowance and EIS changes, are there any other announcements in the budget that, you know, might affect savers and investors?
Well, again, I think because of the big focus on the stamp duty for first-time buyers, then perhaps investors out there are saying, oh, there's nothing there for us. Mm. But actually, there has been a few sort of quite important things. So the first thing is there's some things that haven't changed. We were just talking about pensions, and those reliefs are still there. So actually, if you are able to fund a pension, even a basic rate taxpayer can invest £1 and it costs them 80p. And that's a tremendous deal that so often we overlook. And again, the current regulations permit them to take the money out and only 3/4 of it is taxed as well. Mm. So all those things are really positive. And there was some concern that those reliefs might be impacted, but they haven't been. Savings and dividend bans are unchanged. So in other words, you're able to still earn £5,000 in savings if you're a basic rate taxpayer as well, without having any tax deducted savings interest, I should say. And dividends has remained unchanged as well. Income tax personal allowance and higher rate personal allowance have also increased. So the personal allowance is up to 11,850, and high rate allowance is going to go up to 46,350.
From April.
So, but you know, it's just worth knowing these things. And actually, that higher rate one has gone up by 3.5%, which, you know, is really quite generous.
Inflation beating.
It certainly is. Yeah. So that's positive. So yeah, there's small things, but potentially, perhaps they're not big announcements that we've noticed, but they are things that will be for the end investor of help and of use.
And you can read more about how the budget will affect investors in this week's magazine and the website. A change to tax-efficient vehicles announced before the budget was the news that when you die, you'll be able to pass on your ISA to your spouse in a more tax-efficient way, again from next April. Colin, what's the current situation in terms of being able to pass on the ISA to your spouse, and how are the rules changing?
So the rules are changing in just a very small way, but we'll come back onto that in a second. So at the moment, the value at the date of death, the ISA value at the date of death, or referred to as the probate value, creates for the surviving spouse an additional ISA allowance. So, for example, if the deceased leaves a fund value of £30,000, then that £30,000 on the date of death creates a new ISA allowance for the surviving spouse or civil partner to exactly the same value. This enables the value after the date of death to be frozen and to then continue and increase on a tax-free basis until that administration period is completed.
Okay, and that wasn't the case before.
That's correct. So they would have to account for any growth in that value, and that would be subject to capital gains tax.
So previously, basically, the spouse died, and suddenly the ISA was no longer really an ISA, and he could incur tax.
Absolutely.
Whereas now, even after the person has died in the interim period between it going into the spouse's ISA, it's still tax efficient.
That's right.
Okay, well, I mean, that makes quite a difference,
doesn't
it? It
does.
Yeah.
And actually, the interesting thing is then this ISA allowance that's available to the spouse, it will be the higher of the probate value or the figure when it comes out of administration.
Okay, so the assets now are allowed to grow to this allowance.
They are allowed to grow for the benefit of the surviving spouse.
Yeah. So just to recap, under the current rules, this additional ISA allowance is what the ISA was valued on the day of the spouse's death.
That's right.
But now it's going to be whatever was the growth of the assets or
the probate value if that is higher.
Higher, yeah, when it actually goes into the spouse's ISA.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's again allowing growth. It's a small tweak, but in a way beneficial.
So, absolutely.
Because, I mean, these processes can take quite a long time, can't they?
Yeah. Now, interestingly, the one thing that is included in this is that it's up to a maximum of 3 years.
Yes.
So there is a limitation as to how long this process can go on for. And certainly I've been involved in cases like this that go on for an awfully long
more
time.
More than 3 years?
I can't recall one that's... But some that are approaching 3 years, certainly.
Right.
You know, if you have a fairly complex estate, then that's not an unlikely possibility, but I can't think of any that have gone beyond three.
Yeah, well, it's a good window anyway for...
Absolutely, it's plenty of time for most estates to be able to be addressed and resolved.
Just on the subject of, you know, ISAs going to spouses, I mean, is it actually a good way to pass on your assets to your spouse, or... I mean, how else might you want to do it?
Yeah, well, of course, actually, it's one of many ways you can pass assets on to a spouse. Yeah, it's just worth recapping that anything that gets passed to a spouse is exempt for inheritance tax purposes.
Okay.
So irrespective of whether it's an ISA, a house, a plot of land, a savings account, anything that's passed between spouses does not use an individual's inheritance tax nil rate band. So one of the key things that's involved in inheritance tax planning then is working through, is that the right course of action to simply pass everything across to a spouse, including an ISA? Or is it worth utilising that nil rate band on the first death to create a trust, to give gifts to individuals or whatever might be involved? And then anything else could then be passed to the spouse exempt from inheritance tax.
Okay, thank you, Colin. Some really helpful points there. European Assets Trust, an investment trust focused on European smaller companies, has recently announced it is introducing a tiered fee structure, which should result in its ongoing charge falling if its assets continue to grow. So rather than charging 0.8% of the value of its funds under management, now European Assets is going to charge 0.8% a year for funds up to a value of euro 500 million and 0.65% a year for those with a value above that. Colin, do you think a tiered fee structure whereby a fund's charges become less as it grows in size is a good idea, and is it fairer to investors?
Well, I really hope this is something that's adopted by other funds, to be honest, because I think this is something that many of us have argued, that as fund values increase within a fund management firm, then do they actually require the same level of expense? And so to have a company like European Asset Trusts adopting this is fabulous. I think it's a really good move, and if others can do the same, we'd be really pleased.
I mean, is there anything you don't like about the tiered fee structure?
It's not that we don't like, but I think that there are a few drawbacks that we've just got to be aware of. So the first thing is then effectively the clients could be penalised if markets fall and the underlying assets fall in value, which it's not really their fault necessarily that markets have gone down. They can't defy gravity, so, you know, that's an issue. And the second thing is if perhaps the performance doesn't continue on a positive basis and investors leave, the fund value shrinks and those who remain are then paying a higher amount. So it's something then that investors just need to be wary of what the fund size is as to whether they perceive they're getting full value or not.
Now, European Assets ongoing charge may fall in future, but at the moment it's 1.12%. Do you think this is a fair level of charge for this kind of fund, obviously an investment trust that focuses on European smaller companies?
Well, it's probably quite high, actually. I mean, as a general benchmark, I would suggest anything that's exceeding 1% in the marketplace now is quite pricey. I mean, it does have some very specific objectives that it does appear to have achieved in terms of its dividend targets and its return of capital to its investors. But yeah, in terms of the total cost, it is pricey. I think one of the things we will see next year with the introduction of MiFID II is we will see significant pressure on a lot of investment companies, not only to disclose more fully their charges, but perhaps also the awareness that they will then go through to investors. I think many will be under pressure in terms of showing that they are delivering good value for the costs.
Okay, MiFID II being a series of legislation which we won't go into on this podcast.
Sorry to throw that one in.
That's okay. We'll be touching on that in future podcasts.
It's a vast raft of legislation.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Now, on that note about European assets being more expensive than some of its peers, it's fair to say that certainly in terms of open-ended funds smoked in European smaller companies, it's quite considerably more expensive. I had a quick look at some of the charges of the platform share classes of these, and I mean, these generally, most of them are under 1%, like you said, between 0.8% and 1%. So should investors perhaps go for an open-ended European smaller companies fund?
Yeah, I would never dismiss the nature or the type of the investment. The key thing that you should be looking for is consistency of performance with any investment. So don't dismiss something just because it's open-ended, or don't dismiss something just because it's an investment trust. The important thing is how consistent and how good is that fund at what it does. So, yeah, I'm totally
Structure agnostic, that's the term. That said, though, I mean, a lot of research now shows that investment trusts are generally more expensive than their open-ended peers. Now, it's true to say that they do have some advantages, like the ability to have a revenue reserve and have a safe dividend or gear and potentially make more returns. That said, are they worth the extra cost, even with a few added bells and whistles?
Well, again, I think if we'd have had this conversation 3 or 4 years ago, the opposite would have been true.
Yeah.
Generally, investment trusts were cheaper than
prior to RDR in 2013.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So the good thing is we can see through those things now. And that, and again, the direction of travel for the regulator is to make costs, charges, fees much more transparent. So that is a very positive thing. Is there any benefit specifically going one route or the other? Increasingly not. There does seem to be a closing up of both discounts and premiums now. So essentially they're not as wide as perhaps they were 4 or 5 years ago. So I think increasingly people are now focusing on the ability for the fund manager to deliver what they are targeting. And again, the huge increase in passives of just investing in an index is really putting the microscope now on fund performance and delivering what we call alpha, outperforming the
index. Beating the benchmark, exactly. Because it's true, if you can get a tracker fund, why pay for something
this is exactly
benchmark?
It. Yeah. So you've got to see that consistent out-return and, you know, is it worth what you want to pay for it?
No. On that note, when choosing a fund and evaluating lots of things, how important are the charges? You know, what are the main things you should consider? Is it the most important thing, or you know, or where does it rank, and what have you ever issues?
Well, it is a significant part, obviously, because it has a total impact on the ultimate fund value that you obtain. However, I would say there's the biggest impact on any fund's return is its performance. So if you invest £100 in something and you go back to it 10 years later and it's worth £101, you'll be very disappointed. And then you'll probably think, well, what was I paying for my charges? If it delivers £300 in 10 years' time, you may not be so concerned about the charges. So performance is the biggest impact, and underperformance is the greatest expense to any fund. So I would put that at the top, actually. The second aspect then would be tax, because actually if you wrap something in a tax-advantaged position, then again, it will increase your long-term performance. And then I would then put charges in as probably the third point. Of course, if you're looking at your portfolio as a whole, there is an argument, and there's academic research that seems to suggest that actually your asset allocation, so in other words, where you put your money, in which basket of a portfolio, if you like, is actually the combination of all of those things is the greatest determining factor as to the outcome of your portfolio as a whole. Charges tend not to come up in those academic research.
Now, you mentioned obviously holding your funds in a tax efficient environment like a SIP or an ISA, and looking at the charges. Those are two good ways to keep your costs down. Are there any other ways that you'd suggest to try and keep your fund costs down, even though this is obviously maybe not the main
It may not be the main thing, but it does have an impact. Of course it does. And the other thing, of course, that has an impact is the basis on which you hold it. I'll come back onto the fund charging in a second, but if you're in a platform or a wrap or whatever, there are charges that apply to those. So again, if you're in one that is on an ad valorem basis or a percentage basis, then you just need to be aware of whether there's scales of charges there too, or whether you pay per deal. That's another thing that you just need to allow for. So if you're constantly trading and you're paying for every transaction, that too will erode the value of your investment funds. So yeah, looking at the fund bit in terms of the charges there, one of the interesting things is to actually know how many investors know what their funds cost. So in order to establish that, you need to be looking at your fund fact sheets regularly. They're always disclosed. They're perhaps becoming clearer in how that fund is made on a transparent basis. So that's a good thing. So just keep them under review. But the key thing really is just say, are they delivering what I'm expecting them to deliver?
Thank you, Colin. Some really helpful suggestions again. And see our story on European assets on the website for a roundup of the European smaller companies funds with the lowest charges. That brings us to the end of today's show, but you can read more on the budget, passing your ISA to your spouse, and fund charges in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle on the website. Thank you for listening and have a good weekend.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.